Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, journalist John Nichols, believes that many in the media are too focused on the pursuit of ratings and clicks. They refuse to put the spotlight on anyone but a strong man president. In his new book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America, John Nichols asserts that the media and society need to spend less time on Trump's tweets and more time on his inner circle. He writes, Donald Trump has assembled a rogues gallery of alt-right hate mongers, crony capitalists, immigrant bashers, and climate change deniers. To survive, we the people need to know whose hands are on the levers of power, and we need to know how to challenge their abuses. John Nichols is national affairs correspondent for The Nation magazine and a contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times. He's also associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and a co-founder of the media reform group Free Press. John is the author of many books. His latest is Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. And John Nichols joins us in studio. Hi, John. It's great to have you in studio.
It is a pure pleasure to be with you. I've been with you before out in these parts.
It's been a little while.
But it's an honor to be here, and it's such a pleasure to be on this show. I do it by phone sometimes, or quite often we're doing the media roundtable. And I've your listeners know it, but I'll remind you that you're one of the few.
I wish we
had a lot more.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate the work you do. This book is really important. And you write that this is not a book about Donald Trump per se. It's about Trumpism, mm-hmm. the combination of propaganda, power, paranoia, and plutocracy.
Yeah.
And I really like the argument because we've done a lot of shows about what's going on behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, spend more time on the inner circle and less time on the tweets.
That's exactly right. And I think it's becoming more urgent with each day. When Trump came in, it was quite clear that he was unprepared to be president of the United States. That's not a critique of Trump per se. That is the reality of our politics. We sometimes throw people up into positions of power who are not prepared. But he was uniquely ill-prepared. He had not come up through a political life. He had come up through a New York real estate life and then, this entertainment activities of his. He didn't know people, period. He was not prepared to fill out a cabinet, to pick ambassadors, to staff regulatory commissions, which really defined our safety, our communications, the functioning of much of our lives. I would go so far as to say, and I don't think it's a cruel critique, that there's no doubt in my mind he didn't even know the cabinet agencies, didn't know how many there were, which ones there are. I even doubt to this day that he knows the names of all the people that he's appointed to positions. And I don't, again, there's a lot of them. So that's not such a shocking thing. Ronald Reagan had trouble with, naming and identifying people that were in his own cabinet. But here's the problem. Donald Trump could have chosen, as some weaker presidents have, an inner circle of people that were experienced and who he trusted. Fortunately or unfortunately, he beat those people to get the Republican nomination and really pushed them away. And so he developed a circle around him of people who were equally ill-prepared. End result was that when they started, after the election, trying to figure out who to put into positions of power, they tended to choose the loudest yeller, the person who came in and screamed and yelled the loudest and who was the most impassioned. It was like an apprentice show. End result is you got somebody like Betsy DeVos running the Department of Education because she's impassioned about moving money out of public education to private projects and all these fantasies about how to fix education. You got somebody like Scott Pruitt at the Environmental Protection Agency who spent his entire career suing the Environmental Protection Agency. And what I suggest is that because of this unique weakness of Donald Trump and the fact that he didn't have gatekeepers, if you will, he didn't have people vetting folks very well, he ended up with people who were deeply impassioned about destroying the departments he put them in charge of.
Right. And we've done a show with Jane Mayer. You mentioned her in
Brilliant.
Your book about the lengthy profile she wrote about the Mercers,
Robert
Rebecca
and
Robert. Right.
Yeah.
Robert's the father, Rebecca's his daughter. They're extremely, extremely wealthy. Mm-hmm. And they decided that they were going to support Donald Trump, you could argue that they saved his campaign from going down.
Without a doubt.
Right?
Yeah.
And then they are the ones that brought in Steve Bannon, who then brought in Kellyanne Conway. And it's interesting, your section on Kellyanne Conway, a number of people you interview say he would not be in the White House if it weren't for Kellyanne Conway.
I have no doubt of that. I'm convinced of that. And frankly, Bannon as well. I'm glad you start with the Mercers. I start the book with the Mercers because I believe that they are, as time has passed, they become better known. Mm-hmm. And Jane has done terrific work, you know, really digging in deep. Some other folks as well. But here's the key on the Mercers. They weren't Trump fans. It appeared their leanings were much more toward Ted Cruz. They have an annual costume party. And Ted Cruz was so desperate for their support that at their 2015 costume party, Ted Cruz came, I believe, dressed as Teddy Roosevelt. You know, I mean, it's just the absurdity of people with immense wealth and how they have fun. But they had nurtured up two people. They had nurtured up Steve Bannon with a great deal of support for Breitbart, a great deal of support for really the development of what we think of now as the alt-right. Communications infrastructure, at the least. And then they also had nurtured up Kellyanne Conway and provided her with a lot of support and a lot of backing. So Trump then gets the nomination. He beats the establishment of the party. He actually beats the money establishment in many cases. But Donald Trump was unwilling to spend a lot of his own money on this campaign. There's still many questions about how much money he has. Additionally, he had cut himself off from a lot of folks. The Mercers saw that opening. They clearly said, as Manafort was being pushed out, this is the campaign manager through the convention, we've got some people for you. And the clear message was that if you take these people on, we're going to be very enthusiastic about your campaign, and with the kind of money the Mercers have, that's useful. So suddenly, Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway are at the center of this thing, very critical to the deal. Now, Kellyanne Conway had gone on TV and criticized Trump. Suddenly, she was responsible for making this thing work. And I will tell you one little quick thing that I think is really important. The intersection of Bannon and Conway, which, by the way, I would argue is still not over. People will come in and out of this administration, but they will be in the circle of it. Bannon is, you know, he clearly travels on the alt-right circuit, and he follows many of these divisive issues, many of the ways that you can, you know, get people scared and get people not liking someone else. And then Conway is a good pollster. She's pretty capable, and she knows how to target it. And
women especially.
Yes, and fierce, right? So when you intersect these two people, you end up with a situation like what happened at the end of the campaign. Most political reporters were shocked, and they're sort of, they thought, this is absurd. Why is Donald Trump going to Michigan? That state hasn't voted Republican in years. Why is he going to Wisconsin? That state's not going to vote for, you know. Why is he going to Minnesota? I mean, what's he doing in Minnesota the weekend before? Minnesota's a Democratic state. Well, what they were doing was they were remaking Trump's speeches. I read about this in the book. They would remake Trump's speeches, and they would insert a section about a troubling or scary thing that had happened in that state. And it was all targeted toward that message. So there had been a knife incident at a mall in Minnesota. It involved an immigrant. And Trump flies into the airport and suddenly has this whole ripping speech about this. And he thought, well, what are they doing? This is so absurd. It wasn't absurd at all. This was tactical politics. It was strategy. It was exploiting openings. And the fact is, that's why Donald Trump is president. Mm. He's president because they exploited narrow openings that allowed them to win states by handfuls of votes. They were playing a margin game, and it worked.
70,000 votes in those three states that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. A lot of union members who voted for Obama voted for Trump.
Yes, but let me look at this a bit, too, and I think this is one of the things why I want us to be structuralists.
And also, Can you just talk about the fact that there are many layers to this? A lot of people want to point to one thing.
Yeah, you can't.
And you can't. Right. The Slate just had a piece about Iraqis living in Wisconsin, I believe, or Michigan, who voted for Trump. I mean, there are many, many layers to this.
Well, there are always layers to these things. And one of the great, you know, hidden or lost stories of American politics is that many Arab Americans were very sympathetic to the Republicans because Bush, the dad, had a relatively moderate policy toward the Middle East. And so it's bizarre that, you know, we see grouping. People lock in their assumptions about groups of voters. They think they will always be in some place. Human beings evolve. They're affected by things that happen, and they realize things over time. Now, here's two things that I think are really important. Many of the people who've locked into Trump, who've come around him, are folks who are long-term structuralists, people like Chris Kobach, who heads his commission on voting and election issues. These folks have for years been trying to change the rules. And it's interesting that in some of the places that Trump won, very unexpectedly, that's where they changed the rules. They put in these harsh voter ID laws after Republican governors came in 2010, often reelected in 2014. It made it harder to vote. Ari Berman, my longtime colleague and friend, has written a great deal about, you know, literally the barriers to voting. But there's something else that's lost to this, and that is in 2008, Barack Obama won Wisconsin, Michigan, and Indiana. It's quite impressive, you know. I mean, Indiana especially. It was a tougher state. Between 2008 and 2016, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Indiana became right-to-work states. Mm-hmm. Their unions were dramatically disempowered. They were kicked in the teeth. And that had a profound impact on the ability of unions, A, to survive. In some cases, union membership has gone down in many of those places, but also to maintain that political education. And one of the things that's really striking is in 2008, when the Democrats nominated an African-American for president, Richard Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, went around the country to unions saying, you know, I'm going to be blunt with you. I know some of you folks may wrestle with this question. I want you to understand that the trade union movement has, for a long time, fought for civil rights. And we fought for opening these things up, and Barack Obama is somebody who's on our side. You know what I mean? You did that internal education. You made sure that people didn't allow prejudices or ignorance to get in the way. As you weaken unions, suddenly you make it you break off one level of communication. And in this era where we have, I think, a lot of dumbed-down media, certainly not this show, but a lot of dumbed-down media, and where you have a lot of social media that's hitting, you know, passions, fears, and things like that. If you take out trade unions as one of the educational tools, you take out a protective layer, I would argue. And in the book, I write a lot about these things because Donald Trump has taken people like Chris Kobach, who are passionate about that. His head of the Department of Labor, Acosta, incredibly enough, is a guy who had a terrible record on voting rights over at the Department of Justice. Really controversial. Now he's back in running the Department of Labor, and one of his first major stops as Secretary of Labor, just a few weeks ago, or, you know, about a month ago, was at the National Conference of the American Legislative Exchange Council, one of the leading forces in pushing anti-labor legislation. So you understand what I'm saying is once you start to understand these people, you start to see what's going on.
Your point about what happens when unions are decimated is so important because that also brings down participation, right? Mm-hmm. People who feel like they have their voices being heard.
Yeah.
And they have a say over their job, their family, their community, and then voting. I mean,
unions do mobilization.
Right.
African American churches historically have done souls to the polls, mobilization. You know, all these things. And I am a structuralist. I care about the structures because I think at the end of the day, they tell us a lot. What I want people to understand is that because he has empowered so many people on the far right and so many people who are really of the grifter class of the corporate world, Donald Trump has put a lot of structuralists into positions of power. And even if Donald Trump went to sleep today and slept for a month and didn't even tweet, didn't do anything for a month, in these agencies, in these regulatory bodies, in these cabinet departments, there would be a machine churning, changing rules, shifting things, putting pressure in different areas, really forcing people who work there to decide to just give up and leave, as is happening at many places. And America would be changing radically, even if Donald Trump wasn't saying a word.
Today, we're speaking with The Nation's John Nichols about his new book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. John Nichols says we need to spend more time focusing on Trump's inner circle, really talk about who has levers of power, and we need to know how to challenge their abuses. And if you have any questions or comments for John, he writes about so many people in his book. as we said, Kellyanne Conway, Breitbart, Chris Kobach, Jeff Sessions, a military-heavy White House, James Mattis, some people that maybe you haven't heard that much about, Patrick Shanahan. I haven't heard that much about him, but we'll talk with John about these various people throughout the show. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You have been a journalist for a long time, John.
Too long.
And I wonder what you think when you hear the media, high-profile hosts and reporters and pundits saying that Trump hasn't gotten anything done. I am hearing this even yesterday.
It's madness.
Right.
Yeah.
But he's done so much. And then what they point to is the fact that the Republicans did not repeal Obamacare, but they came so close. And I want you to talk about, over the course of your reporting, how long have you been doing this?
Well, I hate to tell you, I was 11 years old. I rode my bike down the main street in Union Grove to the weekly paper, and I started covering the school board when I was 11.
Okay.
So it's forever.
About 20 years.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So you've seen a lot.
Yeah.
Talk about how things have moved so far to the right.
Yeah.
Because it's really amazing, shocking to see that the Republicans almost repealed Obamacare and drastically gut Medicaid.
Yeah.
I mean, this would have hurt the most vulnerable people in our society,
mm-hmm.
and it almost passed.
Sure. I'm going to break it into two parts if I can.
Okay.
First part, why it didn't pass. There are heroes among us and people that we should not lose sight of, and it's also the people who tell us that resistance is possible at this time. And so we should always recognize why things didn't happen. The reason that the repeal and replace fell apart. You know, like I give a little credit to the absolute incompetence of Paul Ryan as a Speaker of the House. He's not good at it. And so that was a factor, and Republicans in the Senate were afraid to interact with him because they thought he would just go straight for Medicaid, which is probably true. So there's the politics part. But the real answer to this question is that people with disabilities,
mm-hmm.
There are movies to be made. There are documentaries to be made. There are books to be written about the fact that groups like ADAPT and others looked at the threat and they put the alert out. They said, this is the time. This is our battle. If we don't win this, we are going to lose the ability to manage our own lives. In some cases, we may lose the ability to live,
mm-hmm.
right? And they came by bus. Mothers of children with tracheotomies, the trach moms. It was beyond comprehension. It was like nothing I'd ever seen. In Washington, they arrived, and they did not have housing in many cases. Sometimes people in wheelchairs slept through the night in the rain to be there at the door to confront a senator. They risked arrest. They were arrested. They came back again and again and again. And I cannot emphasize to you that Republican members of the House and Senate, Republicans, not all of them, but some saw this, and that tweak of conscience, believe me, I know some listeners may imagine that it's not there. It is. And this is, the lessons of resistance are there, and they are so powerful, and they mean that we can resist anything that we want to if we're willing to go to that level of sacrifice. People with disabilities saved Obamacare.
Mm.
So that's one part, and we can't lose that. And one of the things I emphasize throughout the book is how to resist and to understand that if you put yourself on the line, you can do more in this society than we sometimes think. The second side of it, though, and this is just as important, is the terrifying part. Yes, the news headline went out that Obamacare was saved, Medicare, Medicaid saved. Last week at the Health and Human Services Department, Tom Price, who's the head of that department, and people associated with him announced plans to do massive cuts to sign up for Obamacare and massive cuts and restructuring of the Navigator program that helps people, especially people without a lot of experience, to sign up. So here we saved. Here people risk their lives to save the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, through regulatory means and through executive orders and through moves that are barely reported, they are gutting it out even as we speak. And that's why I say we have to have this two
Right.
Prong.
Well, so let's talk about Seema Verma, who's the administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And you write about Seema. You write that she was charged with reshaping Indiana's Medicaid program when Mike Pence was governor of that state. She was a crafty consultant who used waivers to get around federal guidelines to make a tidy sum of money for herself, somewhat controversially, as the Indianapolis Star revealed in 2014, reporting that the state paid her millions of dollars for her work amid a potential conflict of interest that ethics experts say should concern taxpayers. Tell us about Seema Verma.
She's a very smart woman. And she is a person that Republican governors, like Mike Pence, when he was governor of Indiana, hired to help them restructure Medicaid, Medicare programs, different programs. And what she did was push privatization where she could, squeezing, downsizing, pressuring it so that these states could save money, but not necessarily deliver better care. And in Indiana, the Indianapolis Star, which is not a liberal paper, did stunning investigative reporting on this woman. It was amazing what they revealed about how much money she made, and also the question that was asked, literally asked in Indiana: does she work for the state of Indiana, or does she work for herself, or does she work for the companies that are trying to get their hands on pieces of the healthcare system? And I would argue the answer is the latter. Now, it's very interesting that when Tom Price came in at Health and Human Services, as somebody who's been a longtime critic and I'm really a bad player on a lot of these programs, suddenly she arrives too, obviously via her connections with Mike Pence and others, and she's put into this. This is a position most Americans don't even know exists. But we essentially have a Medicare and Medicaid czar in this country. It's, for health care, it's one of the most powerful positions. It may be as powerful, not as powerful, but very equivalent to Secretary of Health and Human Services. And yet, no big coverage, no big attention. And she is in there with Tom Price, literally deconstructing things as we speak. And even if Congress does nothing more, what these people do will, to my mind, do severe damage, especially to Medicaid and a lesser extent to Medicare. And they really soften things up for what Paul Ryan ultimately wants, which is some form of privatization.
You quote the past president of the D.C. chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Dr. Czar, who warns that Seema Verma's did I get her name right? Different people you're quoting in here. It said, her actions in Indiana signal that she will inflict cruel and unusual punishment on America's most vulnerable citizens. Oh. I first read about her on page A something in the New York Times. It was a short story.
Oh, yeah. And you're probably in the 0.01%, right? Because you do what you do. And I meet wonderful people across this country who are super news consumers. And they will say, oh, yeah, I know about, or I heard about that. And I say, love you for it. If you were everybody, that'd be great. But one of the reasons I wrote this book is for people who are good citizens, who are highly engaged, but who don't comb every column. I wanted to give short introductions as well as information about, you know, what these people are doing, where their power lies, and to get people thinking about, you know, boy, if this really concerns me, who do I hook up with to try and address this? How do I make my voice heard as regards what's happening at Health and Human Services, what's happening at the EPA? Because we have that wonderful resistance we saw from people with disabilities and others to save Obamacare or to save the Affordable Care Act. It has to extend to this agency level. If it doesn't, things are going to be done in our name but without our informed consent. That will be very destructive.
Yeah, and in a time of social media, we are all just pulled in different directions, and it's hard to focus. Let's talk just a bit about Tom Price before we go to break, Secretary of Health and Human Services. In your book, you write, a seven-term congressman from Georgia who freely admits that as a millionaire physician, he got into politics to make sure that the views of millionaire physicians were well represented when healthcare policies are debated.
There's simply no question of that. He talks about it. And he is an extremely right-wing physician. He's been associated with a group of right-wing physicians who actually believe that the American Medical Association is way too left-wing. And their advocacy has been extremely harsh as regards Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act. And frankly, they bring a free market fantasy to this thing that makes Paul Ryan look like a concerned, sensitive guy. And the fact that Tom Price is in charge of this agency with his own many conflicts. This is a guy who's very, very wealthy. It was revealed during the process of considering him for the job that he had invested in companies that at the very least he was ultimately going to have oversight on, and that in fact he had been involved with making decisions about along the way, political decisions. And I mean, this should have been front and center. In a functional democracy where you have checks and balances, Tom Price should have had the toughest confirmation hearing imaginable. And instead, because he was a member of Congress, so he's sort of a member of the club, he sailed through, not easily, but with way less pressure and way less attention than I think is necessary.
John Nichols writes, as Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tom Price doesn't fret much about solving problems. Instead, he uses government, as he always has, to create breathtaking opportunities for a small circle of wealthy Americans, and in particular, for a very wealthy physician named Tom Price. Today we're joined by The Nation's John Nichols. We're talking about his new book, Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. And coming up after the break, we'll continue talking about so many of the people who are in Donald Trump's inner circle. They have their hands on the levers of power. John Nichols writes that we need to know how to challenge their abuses. We need to spend less time focusing on Donald Trump's tweets and more time focusing on his inner circle. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
And I'm Matt Martin, general manager here at KALW, in studio with Sana Saleem, producer of Your Call, asking for your support for local public radio here on the first day of our September membership campaign. We have John Nichols' new book, The Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, yours for a $120 contribution to KALW. You can get that book, you can give your support by making a call to 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917, or by going online to KALW.org.
It's an absolutely fascinating book with an incredible amount of history. It tells you everything you need to know about who's who in the Trump administration.
That's right. This book by John Nichols, he is a Washington correspondent for The Nation. He has dug in deep to the who's who of the Trump administration. So we're going beyond the tweets, beyond the headlines to say, who are these people and what from their histories can we understand about their interests and what they might do in office? 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. This is the kind of work you support on Your Call every day. Every day, Rose and her team take you behind the headlines, bring you into a conversation about issues that matter. You understand that this kind of broadcasting doesn't happen just anywhere in the country, and certainly doesn't happen in the commercial media. It happens here at local public radio because one person at a time gets involved. Be the next person to join in. At every level of support, you make a difference. If you can give $120, that's $10 a month. If you become a sustaining member, we will give you the new book, The Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, yours for a $120 contribution, 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. Now back to Rose and John Nichols.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are joined by The Nation's John Nichols. He's out with a new book called Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. And John will be speaking tonight at East Bay Booksellers, formerly known as the Diesel Bookstore. He'll be there at 7 o'clock, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And if you have any questions or comments for John Nichols about Donald Trump's inner circle, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Mark in San Leandro. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I'm really appreciative of all the work that John's done. And I mean, listening to this, of course, it's a bit like gets frightening. But last night I was listening to Amy Goodman and her colleague. Unfortunately, I forget his last name. Hispanic.
Juan Gonzalez.
Juan Gonzalez has got a book out, and it was pretty encouraging.
Mm.
And he pointed to the urban centers and the political activism and the power there, mm-hmm. and the number of progressive mayors that have been elected. And then this morning I look at the Times, DACA, and that, all that putting the frighteners on everybody happens yesterday, and it's certainly real. And today you have 13 attorney generals suing. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if we're defenseless here.
Right.
That's all I wanted to say, and I appreciate your show.
Well, thank you. And just to let listeners know, and I really want to get Juan Gonzalez on to talk about this, he wrote a new book about New York Mayor Bill de Blasio.
But it's much more.
And it's a lot more.
National. Yeah.
But I read a review, and I had no idea that so many of these incredible changes have taken place in New York.
I'm so glad that this caller came into the mix here. Because it's actually one of the things I write about in the book. So much of our federal government can empower or weaken our state and local governments. It can put pressure on them, or it can free them to do good things. One of the reasons that many of our mayors are doing such good work is because Barack Obama, who frankly was not a left-wing president, he was actually a quite moderate Democrat in many ways, but he came out of Chicago, he came out of urban areas and administration for states and cities that wanted to do some bolder things. And what I would emphasize to you is, if you're excited about what's happening at the urban level, if you're excited about what's happening in progressive states, you still need to keep a close eye on what's going on in the federal government, because the federal government has the ability to crack down and limit or to open up and free. And one of the places in the book, which I actually think is one of the most important things in the book, but it's one that hardly anybody ever asked me about, and that's Ben Carson over at Housing and Urban Development. Now, that's an agency that has a huge role as regards cities, and in fact, I read about San Francisco in that chapter. Cities and housing agencies control our public housing. Public housing was built often in what was referred to as inner cities, or kind of the cores of cities. At the time, people were moving to the suburbs, and so these were considered somewhat unattractive properties. Now, as we've seen this incoming of people into our cities, this desire to live near downtown, the Manhattanization of cities across the country, those public housing properties are in some very attractive places. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to housing experts about the fear of what could happen here, is that if you start to squeeze the money from the federal government for housing agencies, and if you start to loosen the rules, you open up an incredible bonanza for developers, people like Donald Trump, to buy existing public housing properties with all sorts of promises that we'll build new housing. But you'll end up with a situation not unlike what's happened in Paris, where the poorer you are, the farther you live from where you would work. And this is a huge issue that intersects with all sorts of things that Juan is writing about. I blurbed Juan's book. I'm a huge fan of it. Mm. And people should get 5 copies, for their holiday gifts. And the others can be mine, and it'll be a great day. But what I want to emphasize is, we have to do these intersections. We cannot just say, wow, that's a great mayor.
Right.
And not recognize that he or she may have come under pressure.
You're bringing up a lot of things. What concerns me is because so many people are focused on Trump and what's happening in D.C., and I'm often afraid that people aren't spending enough time focusing on local and state governments. Mm-hmm. And, for example, in California, because of what Trump is doing or not doing when it comes to climate change, well, it's so easy to rip on him, right? Yeah. And so then the California Democrats are always lauded for taking action on climate change.
Even when they're imperfect.
When they get a lot of money from big oil. Yeah.
Well, just to take off on that, because it's a really important part of this. There is, at this point, a sense that cities and states, at their best, can resist Donald Trump. And they can. They have power. This exists. But I cannot emphasize the extent to which many of the players around Donald Trump are folks who are experts with years of practice in how to put pressure on cities and states to do things. I was involved in the ALEC Expose project, and we revealed how the American Legislative Exchange Council operates. What they do is they operate at the state level, but they bring all sorts of federal and corporate pressures in. when we look at what Chris Kobach, for instance, is talking about doing with voting issues, mm-hmm. that's going to be a pressure on the states. When we look at what might happen at HUD, that's going to be a pressure on cities. And it will, in many cases, be a financial pressure. So you might have a great mayor, you might even have a good governor, but there'll be immense pressure to, you know, cut corners to get in line. And what I ask of people is simply that we become, you know, top-to-bottom activists. I know it requires a lot of you. It's more than some people have the time for, and I don't ask people to do more than they can. But one of the things you can do is get informed. And it's complicated. I used to I do a thing when I come into a city. I pick up an old newspaper from the city, like from 50 years ago. You can get it at antique stores. And one time I was in Duluth, Minnesota, and I got the Duluth paper from 50 years before. The front page didn't have huge pictures, right? It had small pictures and like 12 articles. But of those 12 articles, like three of them were from other states about what's happening in the state. They were from cities around. You know, there was all this information about what was happening at the city and state level, as well as the federal and international level. Our media has frequently kind of carved out the state and local and just pushed it to the side. And so we don't have – it's harder to get the information that we need. That's number one. Number two, it's harder to see the intersections between state, local, and national. And one of the things I try to do in the book is to steer people toward activist groups, toward still highly engaged journalists that are looking at those intersections, because I want people to – I want people to read my book. I hope they buy lots of copies. But ultimately what I want them to do is use it as a tool to get into that next stage of their life where they are – oh, I'm going to listen to Rose every day. I'm going to carve that time out because she's doing this. Or I'm going to listen to Amy Goodman because she's doing that, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Just quickly on Chris Kobach, because you have a section on him in here in your book, Horseman of the Trump Apocalypse. Tell us a little bit about what concerns you the most. You interview a number of people. Kristen Clark, president of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, says Kobach is public enemy number one when it comes to voter suppression in this country. He has very close ties to ALEC.
Yeah. And also to the Koch brothers.
Right.
And wealthy donors who, you know, I think a long time ago recognized that one of the best ways to win in politics is to make it harder for people that don't agree with you to vote. Mm. And Chris Kobach has been at this for a long time. He really walks a very ugly line. And I'd be very blunt about that. He has been highly involved in anti-immigrant legislation in Arizona and other places. And he's been highly involved in voter ID stuff. And one of his fantasies that he pushes out is the notion that millions of quote-unquote illegal immigrants, as he refers to them, are voting in our elections. It is a lie. It is not true. It has been disproven by conservative Republicans. And yet, Donald Trump tweets about this all the time. He's getting this information from Chris Kobach. So here we have a guy who's telling a lie, but who's influencing our president to believe that lie, and who has been empowered by our president to come up with proposals for how to deal with a problem that doesn't exist. And when he does so, because of the networks he has developed over many, many years, his quote-unquote solution will filter down through ALEC, American Legislative Exchange Council, which has influence in all the states, right-wing and conservative networks, and we will end up having potential for legislation that makes it much harder to vote, to deal with a fantasy that doesn't exist, but it will make it harder for real voters who should be able to vote to do so. And watch carefully, because if they try to tie so-called HAVA money, this is money for that we help at the federal level, we help to fund the buying of voting machines, the buying of voting equipment. If they tie getting federal funding to run elections to enforcing these new proposals, even though states run our elections, you could have Chris Kobach and these people around him forcing states that don't want to make it harder to vote. Mm.
Today we're joined by the nation's John Nichols. He's out with a new book called Horsemen of the Trump Apocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. He says, let's spend less attention on the tweets and more attention on Donald Trump's inner circle. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's hear next from Phil in New Mexico. Hi, Phil. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks. I had two questions for John that both revolve around the question of where Trump got his cabinet and sub-cabinet mm-hmm. people, to the extent that he's named any. And one was the role of Mike Pence in selecting people like Mulvaney and Price, and because these were people, particularly Mulvaney, who flew under the radar when Mulvaney was named to OMB. I'm sure Trump had never even heard the guy's name before. And then secondly, I remember in late January, Steve Bannon made one of his rare appearances at a CPAC conference, and he used a really, really interesting construction, it seemed to me, where he talked about how the cabinet officials had all been carefully selected to deconstruct the administrative state. And that phrase just resonated in my ear, and I went to Google, and I started Googling on administrative state, and I found some stuff, mainly a white paper out of the Heritage Foundation. I don't know, I think it's from about 10, 15 years ago. And it turns out that in this version of reality, their villain is none other than Woodrow Wilson. And they want to roll back to this pre-Wilson view of the federal government and, you know, their ideas that administrative law is illegal and so on and so forth. But as I said, so those two questions, one is the role of Pence and, you know, is he the Dick Cheney of this administration? And then the second is, when Bannon said that these cabinet officers were selected to deconstruct the administrative state, could John elaborate on that too, please?
So, Rose, this is why I hate you, because you have callers that are much smarter than me. and this guy is calling in with a tremendous level of insight and information. His questions go deep into the heart of what I write about, and I thank him immensely for bringing him up. Number one, the role of Mike Pence. I write a lot about Mike Pence in the book. Mike Pence is not that good at what he does. And there's many people who say, oh, don't impeach Trump because you'll get Mike Pence. Trust me, if Mike Pence was president, he wouldn't do very well. He's a mess of a character who managed Indiana so badly that he jumped at the chance to become Trump's vice president when nobody else wanted the gig because he wanted to get out of Indiana because he was afraid he might not get reelected. So Mike Pence is a troublesome character. Unfortunately, the caller is right. He is very close to a lot of other people who are similarly competent. And he was on the far right fringe when he was in the House of Representatives. People that he has ties to, people that he knows, not necessarily through his House service, but through his close ties to the Koch brothers and to, you know, many of these state-based networks that Pence was actually a right-wing talk radio host for years. And there's a web out there, a network. It's not some secret thing, but they know each other. And they were very into the Freedom Caucus in the House. These are the far-right folks in the House who wanted to shut down the government. And that there's no doubt that Mulvaney, Price, and some of these other people came in, if not via Pence, at least via that fringe, because that was one of the groups of people that was much more likely to embrace Trump's candidacy than so-called mainstream conservative Republicans. Now, Mulvaney's a deeply troubling figure because one of the things he does that's incredible, you know, we talked about Kris Kobach, you know, spreading fantasies, lies about people illegally voting. Mulvaney actually claims that, like, the Congressional Budget Office and groups like that are not doing good research. And he tries to discredit the economic equivalent of science. And so in many ways, he's an awfully lot like a climate denier, only with economics. And he's clearly a driving force in this administration in advancing a radical austerity agenda for the domestic level with a massive shift of funding to the Pentagon. And on top of that, a bunch of tax cuts. Mm-hmm. It's fiscal madness. There's simply no question. It will not work. And yet, he clearly has the president's ear. And so, yes, I think that through, and I write a lot about this, through these broader networks, that's how you ended up with some of these people who Trump, you're right, had never heard of. Now, deconstruction of the administrative state or deconstruction of the regulatory state, both terms that are used, this is a huge passion. This is what gets corporatists, you know, like jumping up and down and excited. Stuff most of us don't even talk about. But it is the idea of taking, you know, 100 years of construction of regulatory agencies and oversight agencies that make sure that our bridges are safe, that make sure that our drugs are safe. You know, we can go in and buy aspirin at the store And we don't even think about it. We know that it's going to be safe, right? Well, the companies didn't do that. Our government, for years, carefully began to regulate, pressure. You know, the same with car seats, everything Ralph Nader did. All of that filtered into the regulatory or administrative state. When they talk about the deconstruction of that, what they are really talking about is a massive giveaway to corporate America. And that's one of the reasons why people say, well, Trump is so extreme. He says such crazy things. It's so irresponsible. It's so chaotic. Why does the stock market keep shooting up? Hmm. Well, one of the reasons it's shooting up, some people say, oh, it's because he's going to give them tax cuts. That may happen. But they're already getting a lot of what they want, because when you put the kind of people that Trump has in charge of the FCC or the Securities and Exchange Commission or these other groupings, for the, you know, when you start to weaken regulation and administration, that's where they can make a lot of money.
And they are making a lot of money. CEO pay continues to rise. On the tax cuts, for example, there has been some good reporting saying that Trump is lying when he says that the U.S. has the highest corporate tax rate in the world. A number of economists say that after their accountants get done with it, they're paying about 13%, well, not 35%.
I mean, it's 13 to 20.
But some reporters are saying they're lying. What do you think this is going to come out in the next couple months?
Yeah, and Mulvaney's going to be in the thick of this.
Right.
And so, too, are a number of many of these secondary figures who we're talking about a little bit and getting to know a little bit today, as the tax fight comes, they're going to really leap into the fore.
They have a war room in the White House on this. And the Koch brothers say that they're going to plant people at various town halls to say that they want tax, quote, reform.
Well, they planted people throughout the Trump administration. And so you're going to see all these people stepping up. Tom Price, who we just talked about, will be central to a lot of this, because tax policy is interwoven with healthcare policy. And so this is a very, very big deal. It's something you have to watch closely. And here's the bottom line. If you go to most countries around the world, I should say most countries the United States would want to compare itself with, a country like Germany, right? Their corporations do very well. They're very successful. And yet they are incredibly regulated. They pay a lot of taxes, and they're required to treat their workers well, to, you know, there's so much government there, and yet they do quite well. And so what you really have to understand is that when corporations in the United States, or when acolytes of those corporations, advocate for massive tax cuts and say, oh, jobs are going to come flowing into the United States, that's just wrong. It's not true. Companies that are searching around the world for the lowest taxes are also searching for the lowest wages.
Exactly.
They don't come to a country and say, oh, your taxes are low, so I want to come there and pay really high wages. No. They want the deconstruction of the administrative state. They want something that is so weakened. And then one final thing that I'll put in this mix, and this is it's a sub-theme of the book, but one that I think is really important. Look, we're in an age of automation. Mm. All these promises that companies are going to give us a whole bunch of jobs.
One of your last books is about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just not going to happen.
Well, so we have 4 minutes, and I just want to bring in two other characters in here. Patrick Shanahan, Deputy Secretary of Defense designee.
Designee at that point. He's in.
Was senior VP for the supply chain and operations at Boeing.
Yeah.
And you write, if there was a living, breathing embodiment of the military-industrial complex, it was Patrick Shanahan, a 31-year Boeing employee, member of the Boeing Executive Council, and now the guy who will be helping the Pentagon with procurement issues. This is so important, because what they want to do is pass tax cuts, drastically slash budgets, and spend more on military. Now, when we hear media say spend more on military, can we dive into that a little bit? What are we talking about
here? I wish we were spending the whole hour on it.
Yeah.
To me, this is the most important part of the book. And I'll say it very quickly, because I know we don't have a lot of time. Number one, Dwight Eisenhower gave two good speeches, two fantastic speeches. He wasn't known as an orator, but there were two important ones. Number one, military-industrial complex. We all know about that. Basically, what he said was, you got to be careful, because this intersection of the military and the people that make arms and that could actually create a permanent lobby for a bigger military and even for war. So what Eisenhower warned about, very important there, but his better speech was one called the Cross of Iron speech in 1953 as a general. In the midst of the Cold War, he said, you know, look, we got to be safe, we got to protect ourselves, but you have to also understand, for every battleship we build, that's schools that don't get built. For every weapon system that we buy, that's a road that doesn't get built. That these are balances we have to make as a society. The Trump administration, in my view, via the generals who have been empowered and via Rex Tillerson's dialing down of the State Department and via people who brought in, being brought in all these different areas, is moving us toward a supercharged military-industrial complex and towards a cross of iron moment that is exactly what Dwight Dwight Eisenhower warned us about.
The other person I just briefly want to talk about is Nikki Haley, representative to the UN. I so appreciate that you pointed out in your book, John, this deserves so much more attention. When she was governor of South Carolina, she signed legislation that made it illegal for a woman to obtain an abortion after 20 weeks with no exceptions for rape or incest, no exceptions, and a provision for jailing doctors who violate the law for up to 3 years. You spoke with a number of people who say that this position at the UN is so important when we talk about issues for women and girls.
Every single grouping that deals in the area of international family planning issues, international women and girls issues, says that you've got to have some component of the funding that goes out to help people plan where they want to. Sorts of other health issues. There's a lobby in the far right in America that desperately wants to make sure that our representative at the UN looks at every single proposal that comes up and makes sure that that's squeezed, that that's regulated, that that's limited. And these people jumped out of their seats and cheered when Nikki Haley was nominated to be our representative. So we sit here doing all sorts of other things at the UN. Again, that's the theme of my book. Don't just look at what they're doing on the headlines. Look below it and behind it. You're going to find some bad things happening.
30 seconds. We'll have to have you back for an entire show about this. But based on what you see from the resistance, various movements, what do you think is most effective at this point?
Human beings stepping up and being physically present to object and to bring their own experience. That's why I write about all these different agencies. So if healthcare is a life and death issue for you, step up and speak about it. If transportation is a life and death issue for you, or maybe not life and death, but is vital, step up and speak about it. Housing, go to where your passion is. Go to where your need is. Find people that are organizing there. Organize with them and highlight that. Don't try to do everything. Try to do what you care most about. And if you're a peace activist, get supercharged about the military-industrial complex.
The Nation's John Nichols is author of Horsemen of the Trump Apocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. He'll be at Kepler's in Menlo Park at noon, and then he will be at East Bay Booksellers, formerly Diesel, tonight at 7 o'clock. John Nichols, thank you so much for joining us.
Total pleasure.
And thank you so much for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.